16. The fourth disinformation operation, the Sino-Soviet split. CECU-CBC collaboration, 1944-49. Historically, relations between the Soviet and Chinese Communist parties have been the subject of much confusion. To a significant extent, this was due to a wide-ranging and successful wartime and post-war disinformation effort designed to mislead the West on the nature of Chinese communism and to conceal the steady buildup of Soviet diplomatic intelligence and military help to the CPC in the final years of the Civil War in China. The similarities between Soviet and Chinese comments on the nature of Chinese communism are strongly suggestive of a coordinated disinformation operation. Western journalists who visited Yunnan during the war were told that the Chinese communists were not traditional communists, but agrarian reformers who admired the West and had more in common with Christian socialism than Soviet communism. One, similar remarks were made by Soviet leaders. For example, in June 1944, Stalin told Avril Harriman, then U.S. ambassador in Moscow, that the Chinese communists were not real, but margarine communists. .2 In August 1944, Molotov, then Soviet foreign minister, told Patrick Hurley and Donald Nelson, President Roosevelt's two personal representatives to Chongqing, that many of the so-called Chinese communists were simply desperately poor people who would forget this political inclination when their economic condition improved. .3 In a conversation with Harry Hopkins on May 26, 1945, Stalin made some contemptuous remarks about Mao and discounted the CPC as a serious factor in the situation. He said he thought the Chinese communist leaders were less capable than Chiang Kai-shek and would be unable to unite their country. .4 In the course of negotiations with Wang Shiche, the Chinese foreign minister, in the summer of 1945, Stalin said that Chinese communism did not amount to much. Assurances that Chinese communists were not real communists were given by the Soviet leaders to Secretary of State Burns at Potsdam in July 1945 and to a group of American congressmen visiting Moscow in September 1945. Another indication of an agreed Sino-Soviet disinformation theme was Mao's inaccurate statement, after the dissolution of the Comintern, that China had received no assistance or advice from it since its 7th Congress in 1935. Stalin's apparent ignorance of the situation in China was of course feigned. There was close collaboration throughout between the CBCU and the CPC. Soviet intelligence coverage of the Chinese nationalist government and its policies was at least as good as its coverage of American and British policy. While serving in the section of the Committee of Information that was responsible for counterintelligence work in Soviet organizations in China, Korea, and Mongolia, the author learned of a Soviet decision, taken after secret negotiations with a high-level CPC delegation to Moscow in the autumn of 1946, to step up Soviet military aid to the CPC, the Soviet General Staff, Military Intelligence, and the Ministry of Transport were all instructed to give priority to the Chinese Communist Army. In addition to the Japanese arms captured by the Soviets in Manchuria, large quantities of Soviet arms and ammunition, including American weapons received by the Soviet Union from the United States during the war, were secretly shipped by train to China between 1946 and 1949. In a lecture to students of the High Intelligence School in Balashika in 1949, General Roschkin, the head of Soviet intelligence and Soviet ambassador in China, claimed that Soviet assistance had enabled the Chinese Communist Army to swing the military balance in its favor and to launch its final and successful offensive against the Nationalist Army in 1947-48. Further assistance was sent to China through Sinkiang. Soviet control over Sinkiang had been lost in 1943 when the governor, Chiang Shih-tsai, a Soviet agent, broke with the Soviet Union. In order to restore the situation, a revolt in the Ili region of Sinkiang was organized by Fitton from Moscow, Petovernov from Kazakhstan, Ogaltsov and Bayzov from Uzbekistan, and Langfang and Ivanov from Outer Mongolia, all of them generals of the Soviet Security and Intelligence Service. The revolt was successful and an independent East Turkestan Republic was proclaimed under the leadership of Saifuddin, a Soviet agent. Thereafter, Sinkiang was used by the Soviets as a supply route to the CPC until they had taken over complete control of the province. The camel track to Ningxia from Outer Mongolia was also used as a supply route. A major Soviet intelligence effort went into obtaining military information on the Kuomintang army for the benefit of the CPC and into the subversion of the nationalist administration and police. When the Soviet embassy followed the nationalist government to Canton, it did so not, as is often supposed, to demonstrate Soviet allegiance to the Treaty of Friendship with the nationalist government, but, according to Soviet intelligence telegrams between China and Moscow, to facilitate contact with Soviet agents in the nationalist administration. It is worth noting that Soviet recognition of the new Chinese communist government and the establishment of diplomatic relations with it were conducted through the head of Soviet intelligence and consul general in Peking. Colonel Tikhvinsky. 7. It was the same Tikhvinsky who, in answer to nationalist charges that the Soviets were helping the CPC, issued an official denial on behalf of the Soviet government. Carried in an Associated Press dispatch datelined Peking, December 30, 1947, to the effect that my government recognizes only one government in China, the nationalist government, and is not supplying the communists with anything. This is a 100% denial. The denial was, of course, 100% false. It was but one aspect of a major joint Sino-Soviet intelligence and disinformation operation designed to help the CPC to power while concealing from the West that Soviet aid was being given. After his defeat, Chiang Kai-shek frankly and correctly admitted that the CPC stole intelligence from our government and at the same time closed all avenues of intelligence to the government. That was to be expected. But they went one step further by furnishing the Western nations with false intelligence about the Chinese government in order to create wrong impressions of our country. 8. If the United States administration had not fallen victim to communist disinformation and had realized at the time the scope and scale of Soviet aid to Chinese communism, more decisive American aid might have been given to the Chinese nationalists. Even if it had failed to save China from communism, at least the reaction of American public opinion to the failure of United States policy might have been more balanced than it was in the McCarthy era. Sino-Soviet friction, 1950-57, and its removal. The changed character of Sino-Soviet relations after the CPC came to power found expression in the 30-year Treaty of Friendship signed during Mao's state visit to Moscow in February 1950.9. Soviet support for the liberation of Tibet and Taiwan was promised. Mao was told by Stalin that all Soviet intelligence work in China had ceased and that the names of former Soviet agents in China would be disclosed to the Chinese intelligence service. Despite the success of Mao's visit, there were still unsolved problems and maladjustments in relations between the two countries. It would be quite wrong to regard China at that time as a Soviet satellite. The extent of Soviet infiltration and control over the Chinese party and government was small, compared with that over the East European satellites. It was, broadly speaking, limited to Xinjiang and Manchuria. Nevertheless, the relationship was not one of equals, and at times the Soviets continued to interfere in Chinese internal affairs, especially in Manchuria, the Liaotung Peninsula, Xinjiang, and the border areas. Many Soviet agents, especially in Xinjiang, were disclosed to the CPC, among them Saifuddin, who had been one of the leaders of the Soviet organized revolt in East Turkestan in 1945. He was a member of the first government of Communist China and remained in power in Xinjiang for many years after the development of the Sino-Soviet split. Despite Stalin's assurances, some Soviet agents in China, such as the long-standing Soviet agent in Shanghai, a Chinese citizen named Kazakov, were not declared to the Chinese. Nor were the Soviets entirely frank about properties they owned secretly in China in connection with their intelligence operations. When the Chinese caught the Soviets out, as they sometimes did, there was friction between them. Another source of tension in 1950 arose from dealings with Russian emigre groups in China. Either the Soviets high-handedly carried out arrests using local Chinese security officials without informing Peking, or the Chinese refused to carry out arrests themselves on the scale demanded by the Soviets. A serious disagreement arose when the Soviet advisors, concerned over the unusual nationalist background of Li Kunan, the head of Chinese political intelligence, demanded his dismissal. The Chinese flatly refused to comply. Since there was no formal machinery in existence for dealing with Sino-Soviet disagreements, they showed a tendency to fester. The most serious disagreement of all arose over the Korean War, on which Stalin embarked without having taken Mao fully into his confidence. When the war started to go badly from the communist point of view as a result of the unexpectedly prompt and effective UN intervention, the Soviets suggested that the Chinese should send troops to the aid of the North Koreans. Not surprisingly, the Chinese at first refused. Only after severe Soviet pressure had been brought to bear, culminating in a secret and personal letter from Stalin to Mao, did the Chinese agree to send volunteers into Korea. The uneasiness in Sino-Soviet relations, though carefully concealed from the West, remained in being as long as Stalin was alive. As soon as he was dead, the Soviets took steps to improve matters. Settlement of the Korean War was a priority objective of Stalin's immediate successors and was first discussed with Chou Enlai when he attended Stalin's funeral. Another thorny problem, which was quickly solved, centered on Cao Kong, the unofficial governor of Manchuria, with whom the Soviets had maintained secret contact even during the Korean War. After Beria's arrest, the Chinese leadership was told in confidence that Cao Kong had been one of Beria's agents. In February 1954, the Chinese government dismissed Cao Kang for separatist tendencies and plotting to establish an independent kingdom of Cao Kong in Manchuria. Cao Kong was imprisoned without trial and hanged himself. In October 1954, Khrushchev and Bulganin visited China for discussions that led to the voluntary surrender to China of all Soviet extraterritorial rights. The age-old problems of Manchuria and Sinkiang having been solved, the Sino-Soviet boundaries were then finally settled. Soviet economic and military aid to China was stepped up. On January 17, 1955, the Soviet government announced that it would assist China in setting up nuclear research establishments. Later, the USSR undertook to construct a nuclear reactor in China that would be operational by March 1958. In the intelligence field, the Soviets climbed down over Li Kunan. Li retained his position, and the Soviet advisor who could not get on with him was replaced. The earlier decision to disclose to the Chinese all former Soviet agents in China was put fully into effect without exceptions. Among the Soviet agents thus declared to the Chinese was Sung Chin Jiling, the widow of Dr. Sun Yat-sen. This lady was admitted to the CPC and made an honorary president of the Chinese People's Republic shortly before her death in May 1981. She was given an impressive state funeral attended by the CPC leadership. Another declared agent was Kodemojo, the well-known poet and scientist, president of the Chinese Academy of Sciences and an active member of the World Peace Council. Probably few, if any, of the names of Soviet agents came as a surprise to the Chinese leaders, but the Soviets' evident frankness finally removed this potential source of friction. Thereafter, at Chinese request, the Soviet intelligence service sent to China a number of its leading experts on such subjects as scientific intelligence, the penetration of Western embassies in Moscow, the physical protection of nuclear and rocket installations, the production of audio surveillance equipment, and the conduct of sabotage and assassination operations. During the turbulent events in Eastern Europe in 1956, there were signs of a divergence between Soviet and Chinese views on Stalin. While the Chinese agreed that Stalin had made mistakes, particularly on Yugoslavia, they seemed inclined to a more balanced view of his place in history than that given in Khrushchev's report to the 20th Party Congress. Toward the end of October 1956, a high-level Chinese delegation paid a secret visit to Moscow, criticized the Soviet leaders for their handling of satellite affairs in general, and urged immediate Soviet military intervention in Hungary. One of the consequences of the Chinese visit was a public undertaking by the Soviet government to review the status and functions of Soviet advisors in all the countries of the bloc. Mao Enting Coping led the Chinese delegation. The latter had found expression in Stalin's policy in Manchuria and in the behavior of some of the Soviet advisors in China. The only criticism Mao had of the Soviet decision in 1956 to admit Stalin's mistakes was that the Soviets had failed to consult other communist parties properly in advance. Khrushchev accepted the criticism as justified. The Soviet leaders undertook not to repeat Stalin's mistakes. In particular, they agreed that repressive measures would not be taken against former members of the opposition. They were to be treated as Lenin would have treated them. This explains why Malenkov, Molotov, and Bulganin were not shot. The status and functions of Soviet advisors, including intelligence and security advisors, was settled to Chinese satisfaction. The advisors' roles were limited to consultation and coordination. Interference in the internal administrative affairs of the Chinese services was excluded. The Soviets genuinely treated the Chinese services as equals in status, if not in experience. The Soviets had at last dealt frankly with them in declaring to them all their agents of Chinese nationality. The question of Soviet bases in China for illegal intelligence operations into non-communist countries was solved. New bases for illegals, together with the necessary support facilities, were provided to the Soviet intelligence services by the Chinese in several of their ports, including Shanghai. There were other instances of practical cooperation. At Chinese request, the Soviets built a special factory to manufacture highly sensitive eavesdropping devices. Soviet advisors with experience of political intelligence work against the United States and Britain were provided. These included Colonel Smirnov, a former Soviet intelligence resident in New York, and Colonel Varnin, a former head of the British Department of Soviet Counterintelligence. At the end of 1957, the Chinese asked for an advisor on political assassinations and sabotage. The Soviets responded by sending their best man, General Vertiporok, a former head of their own assassinations and sabotage department and former intelligence resident in Iran. Vertiporok worked as a KGB advisor in China until his death in January 1960. Regular personal consultation between the leaders of the Soviet and Chinese services was established. Shortly after taking over as chairman of the KGB in December 1958, Shelepin paid a visit to China, from which he returned much impressed with Chinese skill in dealing with opposition to the regime from young people, intellectuals, religious leaders, and national minorities, especially during the elimination of the Thousand Weeds in the summer of 1956. Shelepin recommended that the KGB study and learn from Chinese experience in these matters. General Sakharovsky, the head of Soviet intelligence, paid a visit to China at about the same time as Shelepin. At the first conference of the heads of bloc security and intelligence services in Moscow in mid-1959, the Chinese were represented by the Minister of Public Security, Lo Jitsin. The conference decided to put security and intelligence liaison within the bloc onto a multilateral footing and established a joint security and intelligence coordinating center for the purpose. Early in 1960, General Petovernov, one of the most experienced of all KGB generals and a former deputy minister of state security, who was known to and respected by the Chinese for his wartime work against the Chinese nationalists in Xinjiang, was appointed chief KGB advisor to China. In 1959-60, there was a regular exchange of secret political and military intelligence between the Soviets and the Chinese. This covered in particular Western views and predictions on Sino-Soviet relations. The KGB passed on to the Chinese confidential and top-secret intelligence from its sources in NATO and Western Europe. The Polish Intelligence Service obtained and passed on to the KGB a set of papers recording the discussions at a meeting in 1958 or 1959 of the Bilderberg Group of distinguished Western statesmen and commentators concerning the possibilities of a Sino-Soviet split, the likely consequences of such a split for the communist bloc, and the ways in which it might be exploited for the benefit of the West. These were among the documents taken to China by General Sakharovsky in person. Among other documents sent to the Chinese by the KGB were secret U.S. State Department assessments of Sino-Soviet differences over communes and the Chinese reaction to Khrushchev's visit to the United States in 1959. A copy of a secret report delivered to NATO in 1959 by its former Secretary General, Spock, on Sino-Soviet differences and their implications for NATO was also given to the Chinese by the KGB. It is, of course, a deliberately propagated myth that the Soviet and Chinese leaders are ignorant of the situation in the outside world and incapable of understanding it, even if provided by their intelligence services with texts of official Western documents. Intelligence material is, in fact, carefully studied, absorbed, and used in the planning of communist political strategy. In addition to secret intelligence material, it is likely that the communist strategists would have studied books like The Prospects for Communist China by Walt Rostow, which openly speculated as early as 1954 on the possibilities of the Sino-Soviet alliance breaking up. 10. It is therefore probably no coincidence that McCoyan, in his speech to the 21st CPSU Congress in February 1959, said that Western hopes and expectations of a split were doomed, 11 a line echoed in the Basic Communist documents of the period, the 81-Party Manifesto of November 196012 and Khrushchev's Strategic Report of January 6, 1961.13. The theme of unbreakable Sino-Soviet friendship was also to be found in speeches and interviews by Chou En, Lai 14, and the Chinese Foreign Minister, Chen Yi, 15, despite the accumulating evidence of a dispute. More than a year after the reported withdrawal of Soviet economic and technical specialists from China, in July-August 1960, at least some of the KGB advisors were still in place there. A former colleague and friend of the author who had been sent to China to advise on the physical protection of Chinese nuclear installations was still in China in November 1961. The month after Khrushchev denounced the Albanians at the 22nd CPSU Congress and Cho Enlai walked out in apparent protest. By way of contrast, the Soviet military, intelligence, and counterintelligence advisors were the first to leave Yugoslavia when the genuine Tito-Stalin split occurred in 1948. The intimacy of the intelligence and security connection between the Soviets and Chinese up to the end of 1961 was incompatible with a serious deterioration in their overall relations before that date. The discrepancies between the evidence of a split and the open and inside information on continuing good relations must be viewed against the past history of intimate collaboration between the Soviet and Chinese parties and disinformation operations in 1944-49. Which effectively concealed the extent of Soviet aid to the Chinese Party in the final years of the Civil War and successfully misrepresented Chinese communism as a relatively harmless agrarian reform movement. Against this background, the fact that Sino-Soviet relations in 1959-61 closely followed the pattern of Soviet Yugoslav and Soviet-Albanian relations in the same period, a period in which the grounds for tension and splits between the members of the bloc had been removed and all members, including the Chinese, contributed to the formulation of the new policy, suggests that the Sino-Soviet dispute was, like the others, the product of bloc disinformation. The fact that China continued to send observers to meetings of Comecon and the Political Consultative Committee of the Warsaw Pact up to the end of 1961 supports this conclusion. The historical evidence of Sino-Soviet differences. Since the Sino-Soviet split became common knowledge, it has become fashionable, with some encouragement from Soviet and Chinese sources, to seek an explanation for it in traditional rivalries and disputes between the two countries dating back as far as the 16th century. It would be no more far-fetched to try to explain the deterioration in Franco-American relations in the 1960s by reference to the French colonization of Louisiana. Given the nature of communist ideology, the acquisition of power by communist parties, whether in the Soviet Union, China, or elsewhere, entails in every case a radical break with a country's political traditions. Point 16, it would be more relevant to seek the origin of the current split and differences between the Soviet and Chinese communist parties since 1917. Such differences have undoubtedly existed. There were differences between the Soviet and Chinese communists on the tactics to be used toward workers and peasants in the 1920s. Stalin was opposed to Mao's leadership of the CPC in the period 1932-35, but these were transient differences that did not prevent close cooperation between the parties in the period 1935-49. The alleged differences between them on united front tactics with the Kuomintang and in their attitudes to the Chinese nationalist government were false differences deliberately projected by joint disinformation designed to conceal Soviet support for the CPC, to contain the scale of American aid to the nationalist government, and to enable the Soviets and Chinese to subvert that government the more effectively through the development of a duality in their policies toward it. Soviet military support for the CPC may well have tipped the balance in favor of the communist victory in China. After the communist victory, differences and sources of friction once more appeared between the Soviet and Chinese parties. The insensitivity of Stalin's handling of Sino-Soviet and other intra-bloc relations, if it had remained uncorrected, might have led to a genuine Sino-Soviet split analogous to the split with Tito. But in fact, the necessary corrective measures were taken in time. By the end of 1957, there were no outstanding differences left between the members of the bloc. It is noteworthy that the Chinese, in justifying their attitude and their polemics with the Soviet Union, did not base themselves on the real difficulties they encountered with the Soviets in the period 1949-53, but on alleged differences with Khrushchev after 1957 over issues that had in fact been settled by that date. Khrushchev's contribution to the elimination of past mistakes in Sino-Soviet relations was recognized by Mao himself in 1957. The form of Sino-Soviet differences. Roughly speaking, three periods can be distinguished in the development of the split, the first from 1957 to mid-1963, the second from 1963 to 1969, and the third from 1969 onward. For most of the first period, official communist sources aimed GT communist audiences gave no recognition to the existence of Sino-Soviet differences. On the contrary, the record of Chinese participation in the World Conferences of Communist Parties held in Moscow in 1957 and 1960 and in the 21st CPSU Congress in February 1959, and also Chinese attendance as observers at meetings of the Warsaw Pact and Comecon, all indicated continuing and even increasingly close collaboration at a high level between the Soviet and Chinese governments and parties. The same conclusion could be drawn from the exchange of delegations. In 1959 alone, no less than 125 delegations visited China from the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. Over 100 Chinese delegations paid return visits. The evidence of disagreements was to be found in unofficial communist sources, different lines on various issues in the Soviet and Chinese press, remarks by communist leaders to Western journalists and statesmen, and retrospective accounts of polemics at closed meetings of, for example, the Romanian Party Congress in June 1960 and the 81 Party Congress in November 1960. This unofficial evidence, much of it retrospective, pointed to a deterioration in party and diplomatic cooperation in 1959, to a termination of Soviet military and nuclear collaboration in that year, and to the cessation of Soviet economic aid to China in 1960. From late 1961 onward, indications of Sino-Soviet differences began to appear in the official communist sources. There was symbolic Chinese support for Stalin and the Albanian position when Khrushchev denounced them both at the 22nd CPSU Congress. Friction and competition between the Soviet and Chinese delegations at the meetings of international front organizations became conspicuous. The flow of information from official communist sources on the subject of Sino-Soviet collaboration dwindled. During the second period of the split, the existence of differences was fully acknowledged. An ostensible attempt to settle them was made when a high-level Chinese party delegation visited Moscow for talks in July 1963. The talks apparently failed and public polemics between the parties began. Hitherto secret party letters revealing differences between the parties were disclosed in the Soviet and Chinese press. Some Chinese diplomats were expelled from the Soviet Union for distributing leaflets. China withdrew from the international front organizations. Some communist parties in the non-communist world openly took up pro-Soviet or pro-Chinese positions. In some cases, pro-Chinese splinter groups broke away from pro-Moscow parties. In the third period, beginning roughly in 1969, the apparent deterioration in Sino-Soviet relations was expressed in actions as well as words. Troop levels were built up on the Sino-Soviet frontier. Border incidents took place between the two countries against a background of mutual accusations of hegemonism. China began publicly and systematically to take up an opposite position to the Soviet Union on NATO, the Warsaw Pact, the EEC, détente, disarmament, European security, and many third world issues, including Soviet intervention in Afghanistan. After the communist victory in Vietnam, the Vietnamese aligned themselves more closely with the Soviet Union. The Soviets and Chinese backed opposite sides in the conflict between rival communist factions in Kampuchea. In 1979, the Chinese punished the Vietnamese with a brief invasion of their territory. But, despite all the apparent violence of Chinese hostility to the Soviet Union and her close Vietnamese ally, by 1980 the split had still not led to a breach in diplomatic relations with the Soviet Union, as did the Soviet-Albanian dispute in 1961. Nor was the Sino-Soviet Treaty of Friendship, Mutual Cooperation, and Assistance abrogated. Up to 1980, each side remained committed to support the other in an emergency. From this brief outline survey of the split, it will be seen that for most of the first period, there was a total conflict between the evidence from unofficial communist sources and the evidence from official communist sources supported by the author's inside information. In the second period, there was a closer coincidence in the evidence from official and unofficial communist sources. Although there was still a conflict between the official sources in the first period and the evidence of differences leaked retrospectively in the second period. The new methodology, taking into account the launching of a disinformation program in 1958-60 and the historical precedents on which it was based, gives greater credence to the evidence from official communist sources and calls into question the authenticity of the secret party letters and polemics published in the second period of the split. Several inconsistencies can be pointed out. First, the official evidence of close Sino-Soviet relations was carried in the press of both countries. The manifesto of the 81 Party Congress, in November 1960, specifically underlined that Western hopes of a split in the bloc were doomed. By signing it, the Chinese specifically endorsed the tactic of peaceful coexistence as one of the options in a common long-range policy. The Chinese president, Liu Shaoqi, who led the Chinese delegation to the Congress, subsequently toured the Soviet Union in the company of the Soviet president, a curious thing to do if there was a serious rift between them. Khrushchev's report of January 6, 1961, widely distributed in the Soviet Union, emphasized the closeness of Sino-Soviet relations. Second, although the Soviet and Chinese press and radio must be regarded as official communist sources, they should also be regarded as subordinate to official sources, such as the manifesto of the 81 Party Congress, or the decisions and declarations of Soviet and Chinese Party Congresses. These decisions and declarations should not be regarded as being controverted by statements in the press and radio of individual parties, especially in the light of all the evidence of a decision in 1958-60 to support the new long-range policy with a program of disinformation operations. Third, neither the Russian nor the Chinese public was informed of the existence of a dispute before the end of 1961, and even then, up to mid-1963, only indirectly and by implication. Neither the Russian nor the Chinese public is in a position to study the press of the other country and to note the divergences between them on foreign policy or doctrinal issues. It is doubtful whether the reduction in the coverage of each other's affairs in their national presses, even if noticed, would have been accorded much significance. Furthermore, as the author can personally testify, the Soviet Party was not briefed on the dispute up to the end of 1961. In contrast, as already recorded above, confidential guidance was given to the party from the beginning in the case of the genuine Tito-Stalin split in 1948. Fourth, although it would be impossible to assess how much of the polemical material was made available and how widely it was distributed within the Soviet Union and China, it can at least be said that a proportion of the material available in and directed at the West would not have reached the Russian or Chinese public. For example, much of Novosti's material on Sino-Soviet relations was distributed in English and in magazine supplements, which may or may not have been distributed in the Soviet Union. According to the Soviet press, the Chinese distributed polemical material to communists in the Soviet Union in English, which would have been pointless if it was really aimed at a Soviet, rather than a Western, audience. 18. This, along with the esoteric evidence, supports the conclusion that the evidence of the dispute was deliberately made available to the West either directly to Western statesmen and commentators or indirectly in such a manner that Western analysts would be likely to pick it up. The question arises, why would the Soviet and Chinese leaders deliberately draw Western attention to the existence of a dispute that they were at pains to conceal from their own parties and populations unless by so doing they could serve their mutual interests in promoting their recently agreed-upon long-range policy for the bloc? Fifth, the polemics between the Soviets and Chinese were not continuous, but intermittent. They could well have been coordinated, rather than spontaneous. In the Soviet press, they began in July 1963, continued until the beginning of October, and were then dropped until April 1964. They were revived in that month with the publication of material on the meeting of the CPSU Central Committee in February 1964. Allegedly because the Chinese had continued to publish polemical material despite appeals from Khrushchev and the Soviet leadership to desist. 19. The new methodology further suggests that the Sino-Soviet hostilities of the third period, however convincing they may appear, should be re-examined to see whether they could have been staged, and if so, with what strategic object. At this stage, four general points may be made. First, frontier incidents in a remote corner of the world, like on the Ushuri River, though spectacular and convincing evidence of hostility, can very easily be staged, particularly if, as will be shown later, means of coordinating action between the two opponents are readily available. Second, the hostilities, like the verbal polemics, have been intermittent as well as pointless. Third, despite all the apparent violence of Chinese hostility to the Soviet Union and her close Vietnamese ally, by 1980, the split had still not led to a breach in diplomatic relations with the Soviet Union, as did the Soviet-Albanian dispute in 1961. Nor was the Sino-Soviet Treaty of Friendship, Mutual Cooperation, and Assistance abrogated. Up to 1980, each side remained committed to support the other in an emergency. Fourth, the hostilities can be correlated in timing with important communist initiatives or with the opening of East-West negotiations, for example, SALT, or with the visits of Western statesmen to the Soviet Union and China. Like the verbal polemics, therefore, minor hostilities cannot be accepted as evidence of a genuine dispute, and in the light of the new methodology should be examined for the possible relevance they may have to communist political and strategic aims and furtherance of a common long-range policy. In the same light must be seen the adoption of opposing positions on international issues by the Soviet Union and China. the question must be asked whether the ultimate goal of a worldwide communist victory cannot be achieved more expeditiously by the two leading communist powers adopting dual foreign policies in apparent opposition to one another than by pursuing a single policy in open solidarity. The content of Sino-Soviet differences. Differences between the Soviets and Chinese have allegedly arisen since 1958 in the ideological, economic, military, political, and diplomatic fields. To many observers, it appeared that the differences stem from a clash of national interests between the two leading communist powers. The various types of difference must be examined in turn to see what substance, if any, there is to each of them. Ideological differences. Historically, as already noted, one of the first indications of the Sino-Soviet dispute was an apparent difference over the subject of the introduction of communes in China, which Khrushchev mentioned to the late Senator Humphrey in December 1958. According to some Western interpretations of communist theory, communes are the highest form of organization of socialist agriculture, and their introduction ought therefore to be preceded by industrialization and by a lower form of socialist agricultural organization, such as collective farming. The attempt to introduce communes in Soviet Russia in 1918-20 failed because the time was not yet ripe. By introducing communes before collectivization, the Chinese, according to this line of argument, were sinning against orthodoxy in two respects. They were not abiding by communist theory, and they were implicitly rejecting the Soviet model in their agricultural development. By so doing, it was argued, they had incurred Soviet displeasure. Furthermore, comparisons were drawn between the leftist policy of the Chinese in setting up communes and the rightist policy of the Soviets in permitting collective farms in 1958 to purchase state-owned farm machinery. This reasoning was outdated. The 1957 Conference of Bloc Communist Parties reached agreements, endorsed by the 81 Party Congress in November 1960, on the basic laws of communist development, which legitimized the Chinese course of action. As far as agriculture was concerned, the basic law was that it should be collective. The exact type of organization, whether commune or collective farm, was not specified. It was left to be determined by the specific national conditions in each country. In China, the specific national conditions and problems confronting the CPC were how to break up the strong family ties in the vast mass of the Chinese peasantry, how to overcome the lack of agricultural machinery and to use mass manual labor to best advantage, and how to appropriate the land, which belonged not, as in the Soviet Union, to the state, but to the peasants. The commune provided the best solution to all three problems. In addition, the Chinese leaders would undoubtedly have taken into consideration, in agreement with their Soviet colleagues, the high cost in human and material terms of Stalin's method of collectivization, the obloquy it had brought on his regime, and the impossibility of contemplating a repetition of that experience with the even greater numbers of Chinese peasants. The Chinese choice of communes was no more unorthodox than the continued existence of private agriculture in Yugoslavia, Poland, and Hungary, which was accepted by the bloc leaders as a temporary phenomenon until the specific conditions in those countries could be changed. Scant Western attention was paid to the speech of the then Soviet ambassador to China, Yudin, in which he told the 21st CPSU Congress in February 1959 that the Chinese peasantry, in alliance with the working class, is advancing confidently and resolutely towards socialism under the leadership of the Communist Party and has achieved enormous successes. The Communist Party of China, a glorious detachment of the international communist movement, is wisely leading the Chinese people along the path of socialism. Despite tremendous difficulties and constant threats and attempts at interference on the part of American imperialism, Chinese allegations of a restoration of capitalism in the Soviet Union were unfounded. Economic reform in the Soviet Union was aimed at increasing the efficiency of the economy and improving party control over it. The impression of a return toward capitalism was deliberately fostered by disinformation for tactical and strategic purposes. The Chinese would have been aware of this. Similarly, the phrase dictatorship of the proletariat was dropped by the CPSU, not as the result of any dilution of the party's monopoly of control, but to widen the party's political base and to suggest an evolution of the regime. The notion that the Soviet regime was less ideological than the Chinese was unfounded. It is interesting to observe how the Chinese, following the Soviet example, have themselves introduced economic incentives and other elements of capitalism. Economic differences. The disparity in the levels of economic development between China and the Soviet Union, or, in wider terms, between the Asiatic and European communist zones presented the communist strategists with a dilemma. In 1960, the Chinese, saddled with a backward industry, lack of capital, a population explosion, and a low level of trade with the advanced non-communist world, could hardly expect to carry out ambitious industrialization and military programs without help from the European zone. And help from the European zone could only make a significant impact on the rate of Chinese industrial development if the European zone severely curtailed its own development programs and abandoned its aim of outstripping the level of production in the United States. The difference in economic levels between the Soviet Union and China was a potential source of tension within the communist bloc. But it is worth noting that the problem existed at the time of the communist victory in China and did not lead to a Sino-Soviet split in the decade thereafter. As late as October 1958, the year in which the formulation of long-range bloc policy got underway, a leading Soviet theoretician, T.A. Stepanian, took the view that the European socialist states, led by the Soviet Union, and the Asiatic socialist states comprised particular economic zones, and that the former, being more advanced, would be the first to enter communism. 20. However, at the 21st CPSU Congress in January-February 1959, Khrushchev, in a speech that must be regarded as authoritative, overrode this view and announced that all socialist countries would achieve communism more or less simultaneously on the basis of the planned and proportionate development of the economy of the bloc. A month later, he went on to speak of the future economic integration of a communist bloc without internal frontiers. Point 21. Khrushchev's points were underlined by Yudin, the Soviet ambassador to China, who referred to the socialist camp as a single economic system and said that the economic plans of the socialist countries would be more and more coordinated, and that the more highly developed countries will help the less developed countries in order to march in a united front towards communism at an increasingly faster pace. 22. Khrushchev referred to the unity of the socialist camp as one of the advantages enjoyed by the Soviet Union in its struggle to overtake the United States in economic power. Chou Enlai, who led the Chinese delegation to the Congress, and Soviet Deputy Premier Mikoyan both spoke of the unbreakable friendship between the Soviet Union and China. The period around the 21st CPSU Congress was one in which there was a shift of emphasis toward long-range economic planning in Comic-Con. These discussions took place in the presence of Chinese observers. It seems that, at the time, a decision was taken to step up Soviet industrial aid to China. As a result of Khrushchev's visit to Peking in August 1958, the Soviet Union agreed to build 47 additional industrial projects in China. Chou Enlai's visit to Moscow for the 21st CPSU Congress resulted in another Soviet agreement to build 78 additional projects in China between 1959 and 1967 at a total cost of $1.25 billion. Point 23. In July 1960, the picture of closer Sino-Soviet relations changed abruptly. The conventional view is that the Soviet Union terminated its economic aid to China, withdrew its technical and economic advisors, and took steps to curtail Sino-Soviet trade drastically. Support for this view came from reports on the departure of Soviet technicians from China, later confirmed in Sino-Soviet polemics in 1963-64. From the widely different treatment given the subject of bloc assistance to China in the Soviet and Chinese press, and from statistics on Sino-Soviet trade. There were also reports on the economic damage done to China by the cessation of Soviet economic aid, which came on top of the introduction of communes and the failure of the Great Leap Forward. Letters from the communes to the outside world and Chinese grain purchases in Australia and Canada underlined the point. The alleged withdrawal of Soviet economic and technical specialists in July 1960 was not accompanied by, or even followed by, at least up to the end of 1961, a withdrawal of Soviet intelligence and security advisors. On the evidence available, the most likely interpretation of what occurred in mid 1960 is that a switch took place in Chinese thinking on economic development in favor of self-reliance and concentration on small-scale projects. As a consequence of the completion of some projects and the cancellation of others, a proportion of the Soviet technical experts was withdrawn from China in July 1960. If some were replaced by Czechoslovaks and other East Europeans, this would have been done to reinforce the impression of a split. Soviet and East European aid continued to be given after 1960, but on a narrower front and with a concentration on the scientific and technical fields. It can further be surmised that these changes took place by agreement between the Soviets and the Chinese, and that the extent and the consequences of the contraction in Soviet economic aid were misrepresented by each side in accordance with their common disinformation program. Apart from the wider strategic purpose of supporting the authenticity of the split, the publicity on the withdrawal of Soviet technicians could have been intended, in line with historical precedent, to hide continuing Sino-Soviet collaboration in sensitive key areas, in this case, the development of Chinese ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons. Military differences. It is often thought that the real nub of the Sino-Soviet split was a decision by the Soviets in 1959 to withhold assistance to China over nuclear weapons. According to a secret Chinese party letter, which was made public by the Chinese on August 15, 1963, the secret Sino-Soviet agreement on the sharing of military nuclear secrets and the provision to the Chinese of the necessary help in developing their own nuclear potential, which was concluded on October 15, 1957, was broken by the Soviets on June 20, 1959.24. The letter is tantamount to an admission that collaboration in the military nuclear field, up to June 1959, was close. It would have been unconvincing to deny it. Given the earlier publicity about Sino-Soviet nuclear collaboration in General Point 25, but there are several anomalies in the statement that this secret agreement was repudiated by the Soviets in June 1959. The most important is that, in spite of the alleged decision and the fury it is supposed to have generated in China, the Chinese continued to be represented at meetings of the Warsaw Pact in 1960. It is difficult to believe that a Soviet decision with such profound implications would not have been reflected immediately and across the board in the field of Sino-Soviet military relations. In fact, not only did the Chinese continue to send observers to Warsaw Pact meetings for more than a year afterward, but several years of virtually open Sino-Soviet military collaboration followed over the supply of military assistance to North Vietnam. The references to Chinese military students returning from the Soviet Union in 1964-65 indicate that at least some Soviet military training continued to be given to the Chinese armed forces after the split had developed. It is also more than surprising that if, as alleged, there was an abrupt cancellation of Soviet nuclear help to China, the Soviets should have continued to provide, and the Chinese to accept, advice on the physical protection of their nuclear installations. As already recorded, a KGB officer known to the author was still in China in November 1961, having been sent there as one of a group of Soviet advisors on nuclear security requested by the Chinese. Sino-Soviet cooperation in the peaceful use of nuclear energy continued after June 1959. There are references in the Chinese press to a prominent Chinese scientist, Professor Wang Gongchang, serving as vice director of the Joint Nuclear Research Institute at Dubna, near Moscow. In April 1960.26, many observers at the time believed that within the Chinese military leadership there were differences on strategy, which were associated with the Sino-Soviet split and which led to the dismissal of the Chinese defense minister, Ping Teihui, allegedly for conspiring with the Soviet leaders against Mao. Part of this conspiracy supposedly took place during the visit of Khrushchev and Ping to Albania in May 1959. But this visit is far more easily explicable in terms of preparation for the spurious Soviet-Albanian split and the need to coordinate the replacement of Soviet by Chinese military, political, and economic support for Albania. The suggestion that Ping and other Chinese leaders were disgraced for acting as Soviet agents is inconsistent with the declaration by the Soviets to the Chinese in 1954-55 of all their intelligence assets in China and with the close Sino-Soviet intelligence relationship that persisted at least up to the end of 1961. In any case, as Edgar Snow pointed out, Ping neither led a conspiracy against Mao nor suffered arrest in 1959.27. He was still a member of the Chinese Politburo in 1962. Interestingly enough, there does seem to have been a genuine discussion in China between two schools of military thought between 1955 and 1958.28. Settlement of the argument occurred in the same period in which many other problems were resolved in the Soviet Union and the Bloc, such as the elimination of the anti-Khrushchev opposition in July 1957, the ousting of Marshal Zhukov in the following October, and the first conference of Bloc parties in November, at which relations between them were normalized and the decision was taken to formulate a new long-range policy for the Bloc. In his speech to the conference, Mao argued in favor of using the whole potential of the Bloc, especially its nuclear missile potential, to swing the balance of power in favor of the communist world. By their own account, the Chinese agreement with the Soviets on collaboration over nuclear arms dated from the end of 1957. It is tempting to suggest, therefore, that in line with the basic technique of reviving dead issues and using them for disinformation purposes, the argument in the Chinese armed forces was artificially revived, together with allegations of a Khrushchev-Ping conspiracy to support joint Sino-Soviet-Albanian disinformation on their mutual relations. Furthermore, in view of his long services to Sino-Soviet strategy, Ping would have been an obvious candidate to continue to serve in a secret Sino-Soviet or bloc policy coordinating center. His disgrace could have been designed to cover up a secret assignment of this kind. In parallel with the alleged differences in the Chinese army, there were allegedly differences in the Soviet army that led to, among other changes, the dismissal of Marshal Sokolovsky as Chief of General Staff in April 1960 and the dismissal in the same year of Marshal Konev as Commander-in-Chief of the Warsaw Pact forces. Sokolovsky was replaced by Zakharov and Konev by Grechko. If there had in fact been genuine differences in the Soviet General Staff, the author would have expected to pick up some reflection of them from two former GRU officers, Bykov and Yermolaev, who served with him in the NATO section of the KGB's information department and kept in close touch with the general staff. If Sokolovsky was really in disgrace in 1960, it is curious that he was chosen by the Soviet Ministry of Defense to edit a basic book on Soviet military strategy 2 years later. Differences in national interest. Many factors have been cited as contributory causes of the split. The list includes the racial and cultural differences between the Russian and Chinese peoples, the Chinese population explosion, the decline in the influence of communist ideology, the reassertion of purely national interests and hegemonism, or the desire of the Soviet and Chinese parties to dominate others. No one could deny the existence of racial differences. The Chinese in particular have used the racial issue for political purposes. Point 30, but these differences did not prevent the closest possible alliance between the Soviets and Chinese between 1957 and 1959. Nor were they responsible for the Sino-Soviet friction between 1949 and 1955. If they are now thought to have been important in the causation of the split, it is largely because of the evidence provided by the Soviets and Chinese themselves in the course of their polemics in the mid-1960s. For the same reason, attempts were made to reinterpret Khrushchev's Virgin Lands campaign of 1954-56 as inspired by Soviet concern over China's population explosion and designed to preempt any future Chinese expansion into Siberia. As Professor W. A. Douglas Jackson rightly pointed out, the motives for the campaign were domestic. Point 31, cultural differences undeniably exist. But it is interesting that cultural relations between China and the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe should have survived the Sino-Soviet split. The Chinese Friendship Association still exists in the Soviet Union, and the Sino-Soviet Friendship Association still exists in China. Point 32, cultural visits were exchanged at least until November 1966. National rivalry is seen by the West as the force behind the apparent struggle between the Soviets and Chinese for influence in the developing countries in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. The assertion of Chinese national interests is seen in Chinese claims on Taiwanese, Indian, and Outer Mongolian territory and in demands for revision of unequal treaties dating from the 19th century, which awarded certain Chinese territories to Russia. Soviet national self-assertiveness was seen in Soviet attempts to incite revolt in Xinjiang and among tribal groups straddling the frontier with China and in Soviet complaints about Chinese border violations, which, according to Soviet official sources, amounted to 5,000 in 1962 alone. The clash of Soviet and Chinese national interest was seen in short-lived and sporadic outbreaks of border hostilities, especially on the Ushuri River, which were intensified in 1969-70. Border clashes were sometimes accompanied by Soviet and Chinese student demonstrations outside each other's embassies and in ostentatious walkouts by Soviet and Chinese representatives from international gatherings. The manner in which the traditional problems over Manchuria and Xinjiang were solved after Stalin's death has been described, as has the normalization of relations between the members of the bloc, including the Soviet Union and China. In 1957, Khrushchev's contribution to this achievement was recognized by Mao in 1957.34. Against this background, it would have made no sense for the Soviet Union to meddle in Xinjiang. Chinese confidence that they would not attempt to do so is demonstrated by the continuance in high office in Sinkyong throughout the 1960s of a known former Soviet agent, Sifuddin. Far from trying to liberate areas of one another's territory, the two powers cooperated in a war of national liberation in a third country, Vietnam. Before the outbreak of the Sino-Soviet split, the border area had been converted, in Professor Jackson's words, from a zone of tension into a zone of cooperation and stabilization. Point 35. The split was not therefore the culmination of a continuing series of border problems. The frontier incidents cannot be seen as a cause of the dispute. In this connection, attention should be drawn to articles on the border problem published in 1964-65 by academician Kvostov, whose connection with the KGB was known to the author. Equally, anything said or written on the subject by Dikvinsky, the former Soviet intelligence resident in Peking in Britain, should be regarded as reflecting the communist disinformation line. Western belief that nationalism is the driving force behind Soviet or Chinese policy fails to take into account the nature of communist theory and the distinction that must be made between the motives of a communist regime and the sentiments of the people, which it controls. In communist theory, nationalism is a secondary problem. The fundamental political force is the class struggle, which is international in character. Once the victory of the international working class has been achieved, national differences and national sentiment will disappear. Meanwhile, the class enemy is not nationalism, but capitalism and its adjunct, imperialism. It is in large part because of communism's claims to an international, rather than a national, form of loyalty that it has managed to retain its appeal and its hold over its acolytes. The main point, however, is that the disinformation about the Sino-Soviet split provides a new, more effective way for fighting nationalism by investing the communist parties with a nationalist image in the eyes of their people. Differences in political and diplomatic strategy and tactics. Marked differences have existed since 1960 in what the Soviets and Chinese have said on subjects such as détente, peaceful coexistence, and the inevitability of war. In the 1960s, the Soviet press defended peaceful coexistence. The Chinese press attacked it. Under the banner of peaceful coexistence, the Soviet leaders established personal contact with Western statesmen, sought an expansion of East-West trade, and adopted a generally moderate and businesslike approach to negotiations with the West. The Chinese denounced the Soviet approach as a betrayal of Leninism and a capitulation to the forces of imperialism and capitalism. Eschewing closer contacts with the West, the Chinese advocated implacable, militant revolutionary policies toward it. Khrushchev's visit to the United States in 1959, Soviet détente with Western Europe, and the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty of 1963 all came in for their share of Chinese communist abuse. The Chinese and Soviets took diametrically opposing lines on the Sino-Indian conflict in 1959, the Cuban crisis of 1962, and other matters. In relation to the developing world, the Soviets emphasized the importance of diplomacy and economic aid. The Chinese advocated wars of national liberation. Was there any real substance to this war of words? The thesis that war is not inevitable was formulated by Khrushchev at the 20th CPSU Congress in February 1956. At the time, the Chinese frequently expressed their agreement with it. Point 36. It was only in 1960 that divergent views on the topic began to appear in the Soviet and Chinese press, to be followed by open polemics, beginning in 1963. Broadly speaking, the Soviets maintained that, although the causes of conflict between the two different social systems had not disappeared, the strength of the communist bloc was such that nuclear war, which would mean the destruction of both sides, was no longer inevitable. Communists should seek the victory of their cause through peaceful coexistence and peaceful competition. The Chinese argued that the communist aim was world revolution. Communists should not fear world war because it would mean the final victory of communism, even if at the sacrifice of many million lives. The unreality of the dispute is clear when the record of the two sides is examined. The Soviets were far from moderate in their approach to the Berlin problem from 1958 onward, in their disruption of the summit conference in 1960, in their supply of weapons to Indonesia, in their resumption of nuclear testing in 1961, in their provocation of the Cuban crisis in 1962, and in their Middle Eastern policy in 1967. The Chinese were no more aggressive than this in practice. They were not even consistent in their maintenance of an aggressive posture, sometimes maintaining that they did not want world war and would fight only if attacked. Point 37. Indeed, Without Soviet backing, the Chinese were in no position in the 1960s to wage an aggressive war. On the question of support for wars of national liberation in the developing countries, which the Chinese accused the Soviets of betraying, there was nothing to choose between the two sides in practice. Khrushchev's verbal support for this form of war was given practical expression in the foundation of Lumumba University and in support for guerrilla movements in Vietnam, the Middle East, and Africa. Point 38. There was, in fact, duality both in Soviet and Chinese policies and in the interaction between them. Both countries, in different areas or at different times, used provocation and negotiation, aggressiveness and moderation. In the 1960s, Chinese militancy provided a helpful backdrop to Soviet détente diplomacy. There was an apparent common interest between the Soviets and the West in confronting the yellow peril from the East. In the 1970s, the roles were more or less reversed. Soviet aggressiveness in Africa, her menacing stance in Europe, her domestic neo-Stalinism, and her intervention in Afghanistan all helped to create a favorable climate for the Chinese to extend their relations with both advanced and developing countries as a potential ally against Soviet expansionism. Differences over tactics for non-bloc communist parties. Sino-Soviet differences spilled over into questions of the tactics of the international communist movement. Despite the mutual accusations of hegemonism and despite the alignment of extremist communist groups with China and the more moderate communist parties with the Soviet Union, rivalry between the Soviets and Chinese was not carried as far as it might have been in practice. There was no serious Chinese attempt to disrupt the international communist movement. China withdrew from the international front organizations in the 1960s, but did not set up rival organizations under Chinese auspices. The accusations of hegemonism were false. Neither the CPSU nor the CPC seeks to impose its diktat on the communist movement. Neither needs to do so. At the same time, the rejection of hegemonism in principle is not incompatible with recognition of the undeniable fact that the CPSU has the longest and widest experience and power of any communist party and is the best place to play a leading role. It was the Chinese themselves who insisted on this point in 1957. The technique of the split. It will be objected that, even if there is no substance to the differences that are alleged to divide the Soviets from the Chinese, it is inconceivable that they could have sustained a fictitious split for over 20 years without being found out and without doing serious damage to their own cause. If the Soviet Union and China were democracies, that would be a correct judgment. But in communist states, controls over the communications media, the discipline imposed on party members, and the influence of the intelligence and security services are combined to provide unparalleled facilities for practicing disinformation. It should not be forgotten that the closeness of CPSU-CPC relations between 1935 and 1949 was successfully concealed from the outside world. Communist victory in China was achieved more swiftly through the duality of Soviet and CPC policies toward the nationalist government and the United States than it would have been through an outward show of solidarity between them. The technique of the Sino-Soviet split was not developed overnight. Historical precedents drawn on in developing disinformation on false splits and secret coordination, such as Lenin's Far Eastern Republic, have already been cited in this and earlier chapters. The genuine Tito-Stalin split was also obviously of prime importance. And it is interesting to note how the published texts of the alleged secret party letters between the Soviet and Chinese parties recall the genuine party letters on the Tito-Stalin split, and how the spurious allegations that Ping and Lin Piao, both Chinese ministers of defense, were Soviet agents echo the well-founded accusation that the Yugoslav chief of staff in 1948 was working for the Soviet intelligence service. There is also a certain parallel between the Mao-Khrushchev polemics in the 1960s on the subject of peaceful coexistence and the Lenin-Trotsky argument over the issue of war and peace after the revolution of 1917. This earlier controversy could well have been used as a model for the later polemics. The 81-Party Congress Manifesto of November 1960, to which the CPC acknowledged its commitment, spoke of the need for unity of will and action of all communist parties, not for unity of words. Point 39. It also spoke of solving cardinal problems of modern times in a new way, author's italics. What it meant by this in practice was that centralized, Stalinist control over the movement having proved a failure. The aim of a worldwide federation of communist states would be pursued in the transitional stage by an agreed variety of different strategies and tactics to be followed by different parties, some of which would appear to be at loggerheads with one another. Traces of Chinese communist thinking about splits can be found in the Chinese press. The analogy is drawn between growth in nature, which is based on division and germination, and the development and strengthening of the communist movement through favorable splits. The creation of two or more communist parties in one country was advocated openly. 41 Chinese paper used the formula, unity, then split, new unity on a new basis, such as the dialectic of development of the communist movement. Problems of peace and socialism referred disparagingly to Ai Citsi, a Chinese scholar well-versed in dialectics, who developed the idea of the contradiction between the left and right legs of a person, which are mutually interdependent and move in turn when walking. 41 All of this suggests that the communist leaders had learned how to forge a new form of unity among themselves through practical collaboration and the exploitation of fictitious, schismatic differences on ideology and tactics. It would be erroneous to attempt to separate the Sino-Soviet split from the four disinformation operations already described and those that will be described in succeeding chapters. The disinformation program is an integrated whole. The Chinese have played an important part in every operation. As Chapter 22 will argue, the Sino-Soviet split is the underlying factor in all the different strategies developed in support of long-range policy. Mutual criticism between two parties should be seen as a new way of supporting the credibility of the disinformation each is trying to spread about itself. For example, Chinese criticism of Soviet and Yugoslav revisionism, the decay of ideology, and the restoration of capitalism in the Soviet Union helped to build up the illusion that Khrushchev was truly moderate and that Tito was truly independent. The Soviet and Chinese lines on different issues should be seen as the left and right legs of a man, or better still, as the two blades of a pair of scissors, each enhancing the other's capacity to cut. The communist strategists proceeded cautiously and pragmatically with the development of the Sino-Soviet split. The second period of open polemics was not introduced until 1963, which gave time for thorough study of the consequences of the Soviet-Yugoslav dispute of 1958-60, the Soviet-Albanian split, and the first period of the Sino-Soviet split. Even now, precedents exist for the further extension of the Sino-Soviet split that have not yet been exploited. The Soviet-Albanian split was carried to the point of a breach in diplomatic relations with the Soviet Union. The Sino-Vietnamese split was carried to the point of a major Chinese incursion into Vietnamese territory in 1979. Either of these could presage similar developments in Sino-Soviet relations. Strategic objectives of the split. The strategic exploitation of the split will be described in Chapter 22. Its overall objective can be defined briefly as the exploitation of the scissors strategy to hasten the achievement of long-range communist goals. Duality in Sino-Soviet polemics is used to mask the nature of the goals and the degree of coordination in the communist effort to achieve them. The feigned disunity of the communist world promotes real disunity in the non-communist world. Each blade of the communist pair of scissors makes the other more effective. The militancy of one nation helps the activist détente diplomacy of the other. Mutual charges of hegemonism help to create the right climate for one or the other to negotiate agreements with the West. False alignments, formed with third parties by each side against the other, make it easier to achieve specific communist goals, such as the acquisition of advanced technology or the negotiation of arms control agreements or communist penetration of the Arab and African states. In Western eyes, the military, political, economic, and ideological threat from world communism appears diminished. In consequence, Western determination to resist the advance of communism is undermined. At a later stage, the communist strategists are left with the option of terminating the split and adopting the strategy of one clenched fist.